Hey everybody, Travis here. Just a fair warning, Chris was having some mic issues just before he was getting on a call with Mr. Hudson and had to use his Apple AirPods instead, so the audio quality is a little diminished and it gets kind of funky at the end. You'll hear Chris echoing a little bit, but it's not a huge deal. It's mostly Mr. Hudson talking, and you know what, when you got Mr. Hudson on the other line, you don't worry about the fact that you have to use subpar equipment. You just jump in. So forgive us for that, but enjoy this interview.
Everybody want to know what I would do if I didn't win. I guess we'll never know.
So keep it locked. I don't get enough of it. Jesus just rose again.
Listen to the kids.
Welcome to Watching the Throne, a lyrical analysis of Kanye West. My name is Chris Lambert, and today we have a very special guest, Mr. Hudson. Mr. Hudson, thank you for being here, and introduce yourself to anybody who may not know you.
Hey everybody, I'm Mr. Hudson. I'm an Englishman, which you might be guessing by my accent. I am a songwriter, a producer, beat maker, an occasional DJ, I'm a music guy. I'm from Birmingham, England, but I've done a lot of work in the States, and here in London, and I currently spend most of my time in LA.
It's really a bit of a trip, I'm sure, just going from, you know, how can I get into the music scene in England and London, yeah, but then ending up in Los Angeles?
Well, I think anyone who wants to get into music or show business or anything can relate to the idea that, you know, just that first stage, that first level up can feel almost impossible. You know, I grew up in Birmingham and I didn't necessarily have the, what I would have thought was the arrogance to even get to London, let alone leave the country with my music. I didn't think anyone would ever pay me to make music. It didn't happen, hadn't happened to anyone I knew. So that would have been a fantasy, you know, and as a teenager, there wasn't the kind of visible success. You know, we're talking pre-internet here, we're talking late 90s. So I couldn't see anyone like me out there doing it. Everything was much more removed and things were much more tribal. I did eventually move to London and I got into hip hop and I just wanted to work with hip hop artists and grime artists in London. And again, I never dreamed of traveling with my music. But evidently, you know, just, I've seen the world, you know, I've been very lucky to visit, I don't know, 40 countries playing music. Isn't that crazy? So I kind of overshot. I just wanted to get down to London and drink some beer and try and talk to some girls, but I ended up in Hawaii.
Man, what a good overshoot.
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, you're teeing off on the first hole and you accidentally get a hole in one on like the 18th.
You're just looking around like, you know, I've never really done this before, but that's good, right?
Exactly.
That's pretty good.
Exactly.
Do you remember, like, you mentioned that you just wanted to work with hip hop artists, grime artists when you moved to London. Do you remember the first time you kind of heard a hip hop song and it really caught your attention?
Yeah, I was 8 years old, and I think it was the first time I'd obviously heard hip hop before, but not consciously. And it wasn't ever present in the way that it is in North America. You know, we were influenced by hip hop without knowing we were. So, you know, we probably wanted to wear the trainers or the sneakers. And probably wanted to have, you know, a certain cut of clothes or whatever as kids, but we didn't know why. But hip hop has such a big influence worldwide. But the first time I registered sort of almost intellectually that this is a genre of music was when I got hold of a cassette tape. It was a hip-hop compilation, and my favorite track on there was Eric B and Rakim. And I think it was Move the Crowd or Eric B for President. It was one of those two tunes. And I just thought this was the coolest thing I'd ever heard. And I mean, the whole tape was great, but I just thought this is, I was particularly impressed with Eric B and Rakim. And then I went and got Paid in Full, the album. So I would have been 8 or 9. And I was trying to beatbox, and no one I knew was into hip hop. It was like being into snowboarding or something, or I didn't, you know, ice skating. You don't just have a bunch of homies who are also into it. It's not like in the States where it's hip hop's everywhere. So it was, I didn't tell anyone because I didn't think anyone else would be interested, you know? So it was kind of a private thing. And then I didn't really, you know, get a chance to be involved in hip hop until I was in my 20s.
Yeah, was that kind of a first taste dynamic experience when you get to London and you start getting into maybe a bit more hip hop and seeing the scene, like this is what it is, this is how it is? Or had you had enough experience with music at that point to where it wasn't all that different?
Well, I'd been working in different genres, you know, as a teenager. I'd been in grunge bands and Britpop bands. And for anyone listening who's scratching their head saying, what's Britpop? We're talking about bands like Radiohead and Blur and Oasis. And the whole, you know, the scene that they came from of very unapologetically British bands singing in an English accent and singing in their own regional English accent, which very sadly has been forgotten. Everyone seems to just want to sing with an American accent now. But I'd been, as you know, in my late teens playing in a bunch of bands, mainly as a drummer, which I think is interesting, that I then got into making, you know, programming drums and being a beat maker. So I was a drummer on that scene, and I even played in a heavy metal band, which is a real discipline for any musician. So by the time I was like in my early 20s, I was kind of bored of guitar bands and stuff. And I thought, I'm never going to get signed strumming this acoustic guitar. So I thought, what can I do that's different? And I guess I somehow ended up revisiting hip hop sort of 15 years after I'd first fallen in love with it. I've just pulled up the track listing on the World Wide Web. So you've got Eric B and Rakim, you've got Grandmaster Flash, Derek B, Salt and Pepper, Fat Boys, Afrika Bambaataa, Dougie Fresh, Eric B again, Cookie Crew, and a couple of like house things as well on the cassette, because I guess the genre of hip hop wasn't necessarily in the 70s and 80s always just existing on its own. I think with electro and house, they kind of had their overlap. So this cassette released in 1988 is an example of how people were kind of throwing house and hip hop onto the same mixtapes. You know, you've got, it's worth Googling. This is like a little time warp. You know, you've got Dana Dane, Cool Moe Dee, Bomb the Bass, Sweet Tea, Whistle, Spider D. I mean, it's a real like time warp for me going back to being 7 or 8 years old. But yeah, I mean, that sows seeds, and it meant that when I eventually put my first record out on Universal Records here in London, I sampled an Eric B and Rakim drum loop from the remix of Move the Crowd. And it's not on the main album. I think it must have been a bonus track or something, but that's the bit where you can steal the drums, because obviously the rest of the time he's rapping over it. And I remember when Kanye heard that song, he's like, where'd you get those drums? And I was like, Eric B and Rakim. And he's like, yeah, word. And I was like, yeah, Paid in Full. It's Move the Crowd, the remix. And he's looking at me like, okay, you're not just you're not just listening to, you know, Hey Ya and think that you're a hip-hop fan and listening to 50 Cent. I was actually going in and finding remixes and stuff.
Yeah, what was the first experience meeting Kanye like? What point were you at in your career?
I had put that record out and he had heard that song. So I was in a band called Mr. Hudson and the Library. Mm-hmm. And just pulling up the track listing of my own album. Can you hear my fingers on the keys?
A little, but you know, it's Mr. Hudson's fingers on the keys. It's what people pay money for.
It was a song called Cover Girl. And I ended up replaying the drums and crediting the guys with some publishing. But it's Cover Girl. And I think we're talking about like 2007 here, so not a lot of people were doing that kind of thing. And I think he must have enjoyed hearing the MPC drums and a dude with an acoustic guitar, and I think that appealed to his ear. Now, the reason he got hold of the album, Virgil Abloh actually played him the record back in 2007. I think they were in Japan at the time. So he knew who I was when I met him, which is kind of a better way to meet somebody. It's nice for your reputation to precede you rather than the sales pitch. I mean, I respect, say, for example, Big Sean had to like cold call Kanye at a radio station and say, listen, my name's Big Sean. You need to hear me rap. So I have like, you know, great respect for someone who can do that. But I didn't have to do that because DJ Semtex was like, Kanye, this is Mr. Hudson. And you know, we all know those eyebrows that go up when he's interested. And Kanye was like, word, okay. And he pulled his fiance over and said, this is Mr. Hudson. This is the guy that sings that song, Cover Girl. So I didn't really have to say anything. I was just like, that is me. And I started singing the song. And he said, why are you singing to my fiance? And I was like, sorry, man. I mean, it's a love song. I can't sing it at you. You know, right. I mean, I could have done, but so, you know, that was just a quick meeting in London back in 2008 or whatever. Late 2007. He was, so what would he have been promoting then? Graduation?
Was that a Glow in the Dark tour?
No, before the tour.
Okay. Yeah, so probably Graduation.
Yeah, because that came out September 2007, right? So I would have met him in like July, August, because he was in London playing the album to the record company.
Nice.
And I guess another bit of luck on my part was that DJ Semtex was doing the street team and the promotion and, you know, part of the marketing team for the album. And that's also who signed me to Universal. So it was therefore DJ Semtex who introduced us. He made sure that I was in the room, you know, right place at the right time. And luckily Virgil had played in my album, so all I had to do was say, yes, it is I. I is it. I am me. And then we reconnected. He was probably that fall. He came back to do some shows, but it might have even been before the record came out because it wasn't Glow in the Dark, because I did the Glow in the Dark tour with him later when I was signed to, you know, just after I signed to Good Music. So he did some shows in the UK, and I remember going up to Manchester on DJ Semtex's advice, because he said, look, everyone's going to be at the London show. You won't get 30 seconds with him, but if you go to the Manchester show, there'll be nobody backstage and you can chat to him for half an hour. And that's exactly what I did. And I remember being out on the fire escape and we were talking about drums. And I think we must have been talking about the drums on Cover Girl. And that was when we had the Eric B. and Rakim conversation, because he wanted to know where the drums are from. And I kind of must have, in my tone of voice, been like, I can't believe you don't know where the drums are from. Why are you asking me? It's from Paid in Full. And I think, yeah, I think that was a pleasant surprise for, you know, this posh white English guy to be like saying, yeah, it's Eric B. and Rakim. And I had the privilege and pleasure of meeting his mother. And we talked for a little while. And then I felt like I was in a movie because he said, right, I've got to go, and sort of dived through the paparazzi and the fans into a limousine and disappeared. And there I was sort of standing in the rain, so to speak, and just went back to my hotel, which sounds like the end of an Ernest Hemingway novel. But that's exactly what happened. I was on my own, you know, I just went back to my hotel and thought that was pretty cool. So that's where it all started.
Man. And then it seems like that was very much a tipping point from that point on. You go on to 808s and Heartbreak, and then your solo work, and then off into like the last 10 years where you've been collaborating, contributing, and just constantly being a voice in the pop music and music landscape.
It's been a ride, and I've had a lot of incredible experiences, and I hope they continue. And I was just doing a photo shoot this afternoon here in London, and we wrapped up the shoot, and the photographer, you know, he's being professional. He waited till the end of the shoot to start asking me questions about, you know, some legendary shit, which I appreciated. You know, he wasn't doing it during the photo shoot, but at the end he was like, can I ask you some questions about, you know, some of your collaborations? And at the end of the conversation, and it's kind of good because it kind of stirred some memories for us to talk about now, but and some ideas. But he said to me, you've had a unique journey. And I thought, yeah, you're right. And I'm really thankful for that.
It makes me think, given the, I guess, bookends of albums at this point, from Straight No Chaser to When the Machine Stops, you have really gone on that journey. It's been that 10-year period. Did you notice a difference between the process and approach to Straight No Chaser and then the approach to When the Machine Stops, just based on this odyssey that you've had?
I think in some ways, I'm sort of, for all I've traveled, I often end up coming back to the same place, to the piano, to my software of choice, which is Logic. I still like the same kind of drum sounds, the same kind of drum patterns. I still like to overly produce my voice and make it sound a bit like a sad robot. You know, some things don't change, and I think it's okay. There's two types of artists. There's the ones that keep changing, you know, your Childish Gambinos, your Kanyes, your David Bowies, your Bjorks, or Björk as we're meant to pronounce it, and they're always evolving. And then there's the other cats that just say, I found my seat on the bus, I'm happy here. And I think that I've gone off and done a lot of things. And then when it came back to making my own record, I think I wanted to reassert my sound and just say, do you know what? It ain't broke, don't fix it. The difference really between the records is how I made them, because I feel like on Straight No Chaser, I didn't know what I was doing. And when I got to mix the album, half of the album I mixed in London with Andrew Savers. The other half I mixed with Manny Marroquin in Los Angeles, who does a lot of top records, including Kanye's stuff. And Manny was like, "Man, where did you record this? A cardboard box?" I was like, "Thanks, Manny. I tried really hard on this, Manny." You know, I didn't know what I was doing. I was probably singing into the wrong end of the microphone, and it probably did sound like I recorded it in a cardboard box. Anyway, fast forward 10 years later, and I do know what I'm doing, and I'm really proud of When the Machine Stops from a sonic standpoint. I really kind of spent a lot of time on the sonics. I mixed it myself, and then I sat with the mastering engineer, John Greenham, in LA, and he'd just done the Billie Eilish stuff, and I grabbed him before everyone else did. I drove over there and I was like, "You are mastering my album, please." Turns out he's an English guy. He's a well-spoken Englishman. And I sat with him and mastered the record, and at the end he's like, I like your album. He's like, you've done well. And he said, just so you know, I've never let anyone just sit on the couch for the whole time before. But I ended up becoming friends, which is very, very much like my process. It's like, it's as much about collecting people as it is making records.
Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com.
Yeah, I mean, that's what's kind of in the story that you told about how you met Kanye. That was kind of part of it, right? It's the people that connected you. And your work was absolutely part of it, but that's only part of the recipe. The people are such a crucial element to just you get to in life.
Absolutely. If Virgil hadn't played him the album when they were working on, sneaker designs, then he wouldn't have been able to say, I like this. And Virgil, then said, I can connect you guys. And if Kanye and I hadn't had that, if I hadn't have sort of accidentally flirted with his fiance, and if we hadn't met in Manchester and talked about sampling Eric B. drums, maybe it wouldn't have resulted in just out of the blue, me getting a phone call from the head of Mercury Records, which is the label within Universal that I was signed to. Jason Eiley called me. Funnily enough, I was back in Manchester. And he said, how would you feel about Kanye West executive producing your next album?
Sounds pretty good.
It comes down to people having conversations and making phone calls. And I think for anyone who's listening who is trying to look for the keys to get into, to be involved, to be more involved, to have creative success, just remember it's about people. I feel like the music is the fun bit. It's almost the easy bit, but it really is about people. And that's not about blowing up someone's phone or flooding their DMs or, don't be a pain, but just have meaningful, find people you can have meaningful conversations with and constructive conversations. Those can be very short ones. Leave a meaningful comment. Don't just say, check me out, I'm next, I've got beats, or don't say what everyone else is saying. It doesn't necessarily have to be someone who's big and famous and got Grammys on the mantelpiece. It could be, you don't know who's gonna change your life. So if you're always having meaningful interactions with people and doing good work, I think the rest is just, you could call it fate. The rest just figures itself out.
It's like laying seeds for something that's going to flower. But the more seeds you lay, the more positive interactions you have, just the more opportunities there are.
I like that. Definitely.
Thank you. I'm putting, use it in a song.
Yeah. I said that today to somebody. you know, at the photographer, because I haven't seen him for a couple of months. He was like, you know, I was thinking about what you said about blah, blah, and it's changed the way I look at this. And I was like, ah, I put a seed in your head. You know, we can put little, maybe that's what I did with Kanye, was just, I just put a seed in his head, which was, there's this weird English guy who likes hip hop and sings sad songs. And funnily enough, that was kind of relevant when he wanted to sing sad songs. You know, so he thought, get that English guy on a plane.
Bring him over here. Was that, I've never really thought about it in that way, because I think people tend to go back and forth on 808s between looking at it for its almost vicarious enjoyment of getting to be put into that headspace, or even just like resonant enjoyment of like, this is the emotion that I'm feeling right now, and this album really like connects with me being in this state of mind.
Yeah.
But also thinking about like the human element of it, like this really is something that Kanye was expressing and trying to express, that he was going through something. And for you being a collaborator on that project, to kind of go in and have that dynamic between, he's really trying to express something core to what he's going through, this intense loss, but we're also looking at it also as music. Was that something you were thinking about at the time, or was it kind of the vibe, or I guess what was that?
I'm usually thinking about lunch, but you know, and honestly, while we were making the record, I didn't know what it was going to be. And that was my observation about my hip-hop friends, full stop, was, I think I must have emailed home to somebody, we don't know what we're doing till we've done it. But I meant that like socially and not just musically. I just felt like everything was happening so fast, and, you know, meeting so many people, and often I wouldn't be given any warning that, you know, Drake was going to walk in, or, you know, Young Jeezy, or whoever I was going to meet that day. I didn't know they were coming. I didn't know Common was coming. So I didn't know T-Pain was going to rock up with a bottle of Louis Trez on a cushion. I didn't know what we were doing until we'd done it, but maybe Kanye did. I didn't know how much he had planned out. Maybe he didn't want to tell us in case it would affect the process, but it's interesting that I definitely didn't know. I was just trying to help. I was just trying to help make good songs. And I think only looking back now with the benefit of hindsight do we know that as a team we kind of created this almost like architectural space. It's like a room you can walk into either because you know you need to be there, or you walk in and you're like, wow, this is really therapeutic listening to this music. And then of course, as you say, there's the autobiographical element, which I, you know, there's kind of two schools of thought. Some people would say that a piece of art should exist in its own right without any context. But personally, I love knowing what Chet Baker or Marvin Gaye or, you know, Jay Dilla was going through when they made a record. You know, isn't listening to Donuts more powerful knowing that he made it in hospital? Yeah, not that it's my favorite Jay Dilla record, but you know, he was sick and he was making this. He's just like, just that, you know, that passion.
It's just like knowing Through the Wire came after Kanye's car crash.
Exactly, and you can hear it.
Yeah, it adds an element.
Yeah, so I think it's all the more powerful that people feel that when they're listening to this record, and I think it's valuable to a lot of, particularly guys, I know it's we shouldn't be talking about gender in 2019, but from my limited experience of talking to people, particularly guys, don't necessarily have another record or project that they can go to when they're feeling that way. And I think he gave permission to a lot of people, not just in hip hop, to process certain feelings. And I think they can do it and they can be more stoic because they know he was going through it as well. And I think the combination of his story and the listener's story, when they resonate, that's kind of sublime, isn't it?
It's powerful.
The one thing I wanted, the other thing I wanted to say about the process of recording 808s and Heartbreak, the two interesting things for me is one, even though the records deals with sadness and loss, we had a great time making it. It was fun, you know. It was, I guess, because it was cathartic, and I know, you know, he was going through a lot, but I think for other members of the team, when they weren't in the studio, they were having a ball because we were in Hawaii. So I'm playing basketball, you know, I'm eating wings, I'm going swimming, I'm going on bike rides. I've never been to Hawaii before, you know, so it was kind of like a vacation outside of the studio and then obviously serious in the studio. But once the record was finished, I seem to remember playing a lot of Mario. or Mario, as you guys call it.
Yeah.
So there was, you know, there has to be some comic relief, as, you know, you even when you watch the darkest of Shakespeare's plays, there's still a couple of scenes where a comedian comes on. You have to break it up. You can't just be stuck in that one gear. So there were some good laughs as well. And some, you know, the characters involved, people like No ID and Jeff Basker and Plain Pat, there were a lot of good laughs as well. And Cuddy is so funny, you know. Sean is funny. They're all comedians, you know, and we had like Rhymefest and, you know, Really Doe and just good dudes from Chicago, man.
I think that speaks a lot to the artistic process too, that some people might think from the outside that if an album has that kind of tone to it, that had to have been the dominant tone when working on it. But often the process is way more multidimensional in terms of just what the attitude is and atmosphere.
Yeah, I think sometimes for our own sanity, we have to put ourselves in the opposite mood. And somebody told me recently that Rothko, whose, you know, paintings are these huge blocks of color that we're all familiar with, apparently he painted the dark stuff when he was happy and painted in happy colors when he was sad. He's like, we're always looking to kind of balance out the just being alive, the experience, you know.
That's really cool.
Isn't it?
Earlier, when you had mentioned your process with When the Machine Stops and talking about, you know, the stability of your sound or kind of returning to your sound, it made me think of T.S. Eliot in the Four Quartets, the famous line, "We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time."
Beautiful.
It's always one of my favorite lines and sentiments. But as you were talking about that, and just it seems that there are literary influences and throughout your career, but I mean, even with the album title, When the Machine Stops, are those influences typical for you, big for you?
I think sometimes they're not conscious. Sometimes they're just sort of bubbling away underneath, you know. I don't tend to think, oh, I need to go and find something, you know, something deep here. I think they just sort of bubble up and they kind of inform lyrics and inform ideas. But I don't sort of drag and drop from literature, or, you know, from opera, or I'm not trying to kind of be highbrow for the sake of it. I think pop music should be accessible, but if my wordplay is better because I've read a lot of books, then that seems, you know, that would seem to be logical, wouldn't it? I mean, it was interesting to me that who's my guy from Florida, flying private jet with the Roy, pull up in the Demon on Goy, looking like I still do Freud. My mind's gone blank.
Oh God.
Pull up in the Demon. Where's my guy? Kodak Black, right? Apparently, I could be completely misremembering, but I believe he has like the widest vocabulary of any rapper ever. And he's basically said that he used to just read the dictionary because he wanted to have all of these words at his fingertips. And I guess he probably read more than one dictionary. You know, maybe it wasn't just the Collins English dictionary. He's probably like reading dictionaries of slang, and you know. I think that's always good. Like, you want to be overqualified. You want to have more resources than you need. You don't want to be like scraping the barrel. You don't want to be going on rhymezone.com trying to rhyme the cat's.
No. I remember being in college writing poems and being like rhymer.com and just going through. There comes a certain point where you've done enough of the work to where that's not the resource that you turn to because you've kind of graduated from that.
Yeah. I'm reading something else here that says that Aesop Rock has the largest vocabulary in hip hop.
I feel like I've heard that before. I haven't listened to a lot of Aesop Rock.
But, you know, these statistics. I guess it just depends on your algorithm, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, who's going around and necessarily defining it or even the quality of it?
Yeah.
So with When the Machine Stops, I noticed, and I got kind of excited by it, that Johan was a producer on a few tracks.
Yeah.
And I had a moment of going like, that can't be the same Johan, can it? Because I was a big fan of Yeatoven.
Yes.
And actually went to New York City to see the concert and briefly got to meet him after. I kept trying to interview them during the time, but it was exciting to see Johan kind of graduate from that into being part of the industry, getting to work with you. How was working with him on When the Machine Stops?
I mean, he's great. We wrote Chicago together, and he helped me with a couple of other songs. And yeah, he's just a character, and he's just, you know, he's one of those really useful people that just speaks his mind. He won't just say what you want to hear. You don't want to be with just yes men in the studio. You need people who are going to say this sucks.
That's nice to have, and not always as easy to find, I'm sure, as some people might expect.
Yeah, he keeps it 100, and he's you know, his background is classical music, and you know, he knows about harmony and arrangements and composition. And that's really kind of allowed him to go in and offer something, I guess have a different angle. And I know he's been working with Big Sean, and he was thrilled to meet Kanye a little while ago. And yeah, he's starting to get his legs under the table. I'm really happy for him.
Yeah, and I mean, the song, like, Chicago sounded great. All the songs on When the Machine Stops, I've been kind of bopping the last couple of weeks.
Right.
And very much enjoying. It is interesting to hear some of the aesthetic from 808s and Heartbreak, but not done in such a like a downbeat or like a down state, like despite you know, the lyrics are still, there's a lot of longing, there's a lot of regret or questioning, a lot of still complicated relationship dynamics, but yeah. There's still something to the music that has a complexity to it, or like a largeness to it that feels very different from 808s. And I haven't heard a lot of music in the, what, 11 years now between the two albums that I can really say this feels like an extension of that, but a dynamic change. So it was cool just to be able to listen to When the Machine Stops and hear that sound done in just a whole new way that I can enjoy like a classic, but get the updatedness. Cause I think that's one of the things we all keep wanting from music, right? Like, what's that next step forward? What's that next?
I'm always trying to make something I haven't heard yet. And even if I'm revisiting something, I'm still trying to say, how does this need to sound in 2020? Or how, you know, can I make something that I haven't heard yet? I think, you know, it's interesting that one of the contrasts with 808s is, you know, that's 808s and Heartbreak. I'm not heartbroken. I'm, you know, the songs on the record are sad. But it, what an American word I love that that we don't really have an equivalent of is salty. And I think the album's kind of salty. It's kind of like, oh, so you want to, you know, you want to ghost me now, huh? It's like, it's just salty, but I'm still standing. You know, it's a really interesting sort of genre, the kind of sad record, but you're prevailing. You know, it's the kind of characters that Denzel Washington always plays. It's like, he's going through it, but don't mess with him. Like, he's still completely functional, thank you very much. Like, he will still break your arm, but he's going through it, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of my headspace is, you know, I'm still doing my thing, but I'm dealing with shit. And it's kind of that soundtrack for me.
Which is empowering in a different way. And I think we need that kind of kaleidoscope of emotion, right? Like, sad, but still having the ability to keep your head held high and know that you'll be okay, but just wanting to express some things. Is exactly. Something people need to hear just as much as like, I'm so fucking sad and I don't know what I'm gonna do about it. Like,
there's enough people, you know, with kind of I'm afraid to say sort of suicidal anthems, and I'm like, wow, I personally don't want to hear this. I don't know, like, is it helpful for people to hear that stuff? I'm writing songs that are more about, it's like that old Frank Sinatra song, One for My Baby, One for the Road. It's like he's been dumped. He's heartbroken, but you know what? He's still in the bar. He's having another round, and he's gonna get laid, just with the wrong person, you know.
Yeah.
And he's gonna get to work in the morning, and he's gonna have a hangover, but he's gonna keep it moving, and he's gonna keep throwing punches. So I guess I think I've been making music in that headspace personally. I think that's kind of where I'm at.
I like the idea that sometimes a step backwards can be a step forwards, just in the sense that you're not staying put and you're not stagnant. And
people love saying don't look back. I'm like, what do you mean don't look back? It looks great. You know?
Right.
Why can't you have both? Why can't you have looking back, enjoying the present, and planning for the future? People love the binary solutions. I can't eat gluten. I'm not eating carbohydrates. You know, I don't listen to classical music. I'm not, you know, I'm chill. Like, you know, whatever happened to moderation? Like, look back occasionally and learn from your mistakes and celebrate those wins, how it, you know, even if it was 15 years ago or 5 years ago or last week, you should be allowed to enjoy the past and learn from the past, but also planning for the future. I don't know. I'm not the binary guy.
No, binary kind of gets annoying. You're just like, there's more to this than just the yes or the no, the black and the white. Like, There's depth here.
Absolutely. Life's more complicated than that, but people like binary solutions.
They are simple.
Yeah. They're brutal.
Yes, very much, yes.
But, I think of my English teacher who said, I will never listen to hip-hop. It's not real music. And I remember thinking, bro, you're missing out on some poetry. Some good, you know, you're just missing out on this whole world of like wordplay, and you love words, and they're in the English language, and you're an English teacher, you know. So, people miss out by being binary.
They really do. Well, I think we've reached the point of the last call, and this is
that was episode one.
What's that?
That was episode one.
Was. Look forward to the rest of the volumes. So this is your uninterrupted time to talk about whatever you want. And thank you so much for being on the show.
Man, it's my pleasure. Yeah, I would just love to say to everyone, go and check out the new album. You know, it's the kind of the most pure statement I've made of my authorship. In terms of having my hands on the steering wheel through the whole thing, and I think it's the best thing I've ever made. I'm really proud of it, and I would love to hear people's thoughts. Hit me up on the usual channels. I'm probably most likely to see you on Insta. Probably most likely to be visible. So hit me on @MrHudson. I love the record. Give it a listen, play it in the car, it should sound good in the Hyundai, and I better get working on the next one, so let me know what you think. Take care, y'all. And they ask me, I tell them, raise your glasses to the sky. This is the last call for alcohol. For-